STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hey there, folks. This is the STRS podcast. I'm Melinda the Enforcer. I'm with Greg Kokel. He's going to answer your questions on a timer in 4 minutes or less. It's a short podcast, and Tim Barnett tweeted it was a short podcast for short people, but that's not true. It's for all sizes of people. It's just short answers. So this podcast is we post a new podcast every Monday. This will be going up Monday, which is February 8th. So that isn't like February 11th one of your radio anniversaries
it,
or something?
It is. It is my radio anniversary. So I'll be starting my 27th year, I think.
You'll be celebrating your 26th year.
I know.
And anniversaries are for completing what you complete. I told you this before. It drives me crazy when you do that.
I
know you're saying it right now to annoy me, but you're saying it. You've always said it, and I just recently told you that it annoys me.
I just had this instinct that it would bother you, so I have done that.
Anniversaries are for the completion of the year, not the beginning of it. You don't get to steal next year's credit.
Yes, Mom.
So it's 20. Well, it's 26 years. Things should be done properly. So, anyways, 26 years.
Yeah, but
radio.
What is next Monday?
February 8th. I just said that.
No, but we've had this before. Next isn't the one coming up. Oh. It's the following one. It's Monday, and then next Monday is a week and a half away. That was your deal.
No, it's.
I always think it's the next Monday is the next Monday, but you've said, no, that's not right. Monday is Monday, and the next Monday is the Monday
this Monday and next Monday.
So
anyways.
That's why I get the big bucks. When I have to
is that why?
All right.
I was wondering. Okay. So why don't you just give people a really short, this is a short answer, is how you got on radio. So that was... I can tell you.
That was almost 27 years ago.
Because it was a little bit... You were talking...
Well,
You had interviewed on the longer podcast Dr. Hugh Ross about God's providence in his life through some unusual... And this is an example of God's providence.
Well, okay,
there
was a convergence of things that were happening. One of them was... I got a phone call in an evening. I can kind of still picture it. I had a piece of pizza in my hand, and somebody asked me, is it okay if we put your name in on a radio program there in Southern California, the ABC affiliate, called Religion on the Line? And they had a pastor and a priest and a rabbi and then a Jewish talk show host, who was
Dennis Prager.
Yeah, way back when
he
in the 80s.
A local guy then.
A local guy at the ABC here in Los Angeles, and I said, sure, put my name in as a pastor, and then I got invited to do the show, and then I turned out I did about 25 shows over the next 3 or 4 years, and this is where I built my relationship with Dennis, and so that was happening, and at the same time, I was teaching at my church at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, where I was a pastor, and I'd be filling in for the pastor when days he was gone, and it turned out that the programming director for a local Christian station
KBRT.
Here in Southern California, KBRT, went to our church, and when one of their main talents was moving on from there, it left a big hole in the lineup, and so she said, would you mind testing for a radio show? This was the end of 1999, December 1999, and I said...
February 11th, 1990, 26 years
ago. No, I mean not 1999, 89.
89,
that's right. And so I said, sure, why not? What the heck? So this is another kind of serendipitous mm-hmm. thing, and so I went and I tested, and they gave me the job, and that was
26th anniversary.
I was just trying to find a way to say it that
I
would
know
annoy
you,
but I couldn't. It wasn't that
There's
quick
no way to do
on
it.
My feet. So, and, you know, then 1 year passed, and then 2 years, and then 3 years. It was actually about a year or so into doing talk radio Saturday and Sunday for 3 hours from 3 to 6 that I, before I found the format that came to be the standard reason format, answering questions, interacting and stuff, before that it was news talk where you did a different topic every hour, and I really did not like that. But I did that for 8 years with the Crawford Network, and then in the meantime, 3 years into that, or 4 years into that, we started Standard Reason, and that became a problem working for two people, and so I quit with Crawford, and then we as an organization bought the same time back one day a week. And,
well, for a long time, actually, after we started Standard Reason, we called the show Standard Reason, but you were still working for them.
We did call it
that.
And then
after a few years,
right.
Actually, then we had some volunteers early on who were tech people.
Yeah.
And one of them, before the word podcast existed, some of them said, hey, we should be posting these shows online.
Yeah, real audio.
Right. And so then it was important. We had to own the programming.
Right.
But, and then, I mean, you were already doing radio when we started Standard Reason, and then that became an integral part of Standard
Reason. Absolutely, yeah.
But then also we were all, you know, transcribing commentaries, and that was some of our very first material. We used to, you know, copy them and mail them out before email was just brand
new. And we'd capture the name.
Yeah, and as soon as we had, and then again, some of these same early volunteers built us a website in 1995 or 96.
Right.
And those articles became the first content on our website.
Right,
so,
right.
So those, having already
those articles
been in radio,
are still there, many of them.
Yeah,
most
we
of
had
them, probably.
Momentum going on.
Right. These were all, and I'm glad the way you introduced this was kind of the providential elements, the apparently serendipitous events that all kind of converged to really make a fertile ground for Standard Reason to grow, having this radio background and these relationships with Dennis that has continued all these years, and having that opportunity to develop a little bit on air in a not competitive, what's the word I'm looking for? We had different ideas being aired by rabbi, Roman Catholic priest, Protestant Dennis, interacting in that situation, then doing our own show and having these commentaries and mailing them out as people sent in an envelope to get the commentary, and then we captured the name, and all of this then became the raw material for the organization Standard Reason when we started in May 1st, 1993. So this, none of this was planned. I didn't plan to construct this organization by setting up this step-by-step enterprise. I just was I was blooming where I was planted, taking the opportunities that God had for me, and God in His providence brought all this together, and then has continued it all these years. These now
26 years.
Well, actually, it won't be 27 till February 11th. So that
be
is the
26 until February 11th. It's a good thing you answered the phone instead of eating
February
your pizza
11,
that
20,
night.
20,
okay.
Well, I
never
did both.
Never mind. Let's just get down to work now, okay? All right, first question comes from ID Landerson, 2016. What do you do when you have a business? What do you do? Greg, by the way, Greg runs his phone, so he's timing himself too.
I'm
so
kidding.
He knows.
I'm getting
so
my
he's
phone.
Quickly grabbing his phone. He forgot to get it going. What do you do when you have a business relationship with a friend who is or was a professing Christian but is now living in sin? And he doesn't specify what kind of sin.
Well, what is that noise?
Sure, it's
is that my phone?
No, it's Brooke. We always play it every show.
I never have heard this before. I thought, now you're trying to keep me honest.
She plays at the first answer of every show.
She stopped it.
You're using your time. Well, we only play a short bit of it.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
So it doesn't distract you like apparently it did.
There it is again. I feel like Captain Hook.
You've used 30 seconds of your time.
All right. Well, if the person professes to be a Christian, in some sense, I think it is appropriate to confront the person on the conflict between their behavior and their profession. If a brother is caught in a trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one, looking to yourself, lest you also be tempted. This is Galatians 6. This is the job that we have. If the person is just completely abandoned the faith, then we're to treat them like a non-believer, it seems to me. And what that means is not that we treat them badly, it's just that we don't expect them to live the way a Christian is supposed to live. So a lot depends on what his assessment is, or maybe what the the business partner's declaration is. If the business partner still considers himself a Christian, then I think it's appropriate to have a conversation about the behavior. If he does not consider himself a Christian, well, then the circumstances are different. Then he's, evangelism is the appropriate thing there, not discipline. But it may be, since he's already been there, done that in his own mind, that evangelism is going to be difficult, but not impossible in that situation. So I guess my response is, it depends on what that person declares about his own situation, whether he really believes himself to be a Christian or not anymore.
Do you think being unequally yoked applies to business relationships?
Well, I think it does apply to business relationships, but I don't think that it means that one can never have a business relationship with a non-Christian. It just depends on the nature of the yoking. I mean, the fact is, most of us are in business relationships of some sort with non-Christians. The point of the this is in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, I think, or 5 maybe, but the what Paul says in the illustration of unequally yoked is a pair of oxen that are in the same yoke, where one oxen could pull the other one off the trail, okay? And so what God doesn't want us to be in is in the kind of relationship that ties us to someone in a way that they could then pull us off the track. And so that would apply to certain types of business relationships where you're contractually connected with somebody who may, or the possibility is that you're contractually connected with them in a way that's going to compromise your Christian convictions in some sense. Certainly this applies to marriage very, very clearly. But some relationships are not like that. And so I think people have to make their own assessment. We want to be protected, though, so that we are not walking in the counsel of the wicked, as Psalm 1 says. So that would enter into the assessment as well.
Good. Next question comes from...
3 minutes and 41 seconds there, by the way, even with the diversion. Still got it.
We're not scoring you. It's not a game. Next question comes from Taco Terrence. How much temptation is from man's nature as opposed to Satan? Is there any way to measure this? Is Satan given too much credit for temptation?
I don't see how there's a way to measure it. I actually think, is he given too much credit? I don't think he's given hardly any credit.
Wilson in the 70s say the devil made me do it.
Yeah, devil made me do it, right. But I don't think most people think that way now. I honestly don't. I could be wrong on this, but I don't.
Probably in some denominational circles they think that much
Maybe. I don't know. But it seems to me, if anything, the devil's getting the short shrift. And in fact, in the Credo book, I talk about this a little bit because he's the third player in our drama, our narrative. You got God, man, devil, and he's an important player. And if we give him the short shrift, if we don't take him seriously, this is dangerous because one of his devices is stealth. If he can operate below the radar, he can do lots of damage. And this is why we have to be sober-minded about him. I think it's hard to know in any situation the role the devil has in that. And I don't, as I recall, the scripture doesn't give us a whole lot of insight in that. That is, the particular role he has in given situations. It gives us general ideas. He's a deceiver, a liar. He's a tempter. We don't want to have a root of bitterness, so we don't give the devil an opportunity. So that's a hint that that's something that he might take advantage of, unforgiveness and the like. So, but these are all general things, but I think that we are not as alert as we might be to his deceptive influence. And so I think if anything, we're giving him less attention than, or we figure it, if we calc, what's the word I'm looking for? We factor him in too little to the influence he has on men nowadays, because we're just modern folk, and so we don't take that so seriously anymore. But we ought to, and it's dangerous that we don't. But other than that, I don't think there's really any way to quantify the role that Satan has in our temptations as opposed to our flesh. We are plenty capable of doing lots of bad things. In fact, Jesus himself says it isn't what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of him. And in James chapter 1, there's discussion about how temptation develops and progresses towards sin, and there's no mention of the devil there either. So we're plenty capable all on our own.
So in any given temptation, it's not necessarily important to figure out, oh, is this coming from me or from the devil?
No, I don't see why it is.
We resist it. We stand
exactly.
in the Word.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yes. Well put. Give yourself a raise.
Roman Catholics often defend their doctrine, practices, and authority by saying something like, it's been that way since the early church. And, you know, they do claim, you know, history all the way going back to the apostles is on their side. Is this sort of reasoning sound? Is it proper and effective logic to appeal to historical continuity?
I think there's merit to those kinds of arguments. But I think these kind of arguments are more important when we're talking about the anti-Nicene fathers, that is, the fathers before the Council of Nicaea. So when you're talking about Polycarp and Irenaeus and Tertullian and those of that like second century era, I think it's safer because these in some cases were disciples of apostles or disciples of apostles. So you're not as far removed from the apostolic witness and the personalities that were actually trained by Jesus themselves. But we know by looking at the book of, say, 1 Corinthians, that it didn't take long for Christians to get really screwed up in the things that they believed and the way they practiced their faith. And so 1 Corinthians is a huge corrective of abuse. And other books, it contains some of that as well. And so that's why when you get much further down the line, it becomes much more risky to say, well, this is the way the church has always done it. Because it might be they've been doing it wrong for a long time. You know, it's like the carpenter who's just doing it wrong. You say, well, you know, maybe you ought to put the nail this way and that. Well, I've been doing it this way for 20 years, as if just the length of time is the thing that gives it credibility. Of course, I'm thinking, hey, well, you've been doing it wrong for 20 years, you know. So the same thing, I think, applies with tradition. It might be that the wrong traditions got started fairly early, and then they just continued. And so looking at the duration of the tradition itself is not enough to make the case. The biblical warrant, I think, is the thing that matters, because this takes you back to the canon, the rule, that which is adjudicated these matters. That would be the apostles, or in the absence of the apostles since their demise, the things that the apostles wrote, and that would be the standard. Sometimes you have traditions that are not addressed one way or another by any of the writings, and they strike me as rather benign. If they are not addressed one way or another, you know, then nothing wrong with doing them, as long as they don't purport to have. I'm trying to think of how I want to put this. Look, if the Bible doesn't speak to it, it's okay to do it, but we don't want to hang on to it like this is God's word or God's principle as opposed to man's principle. Lots of things that men come up with, that's fine, but very quickly they can get away in the way of God's teaching and actually contravene it. And this Jesus spoke to frequently. Now, just one other thought on
Pharisees
this.
Have done the same thing.
Exactly. You have your tradition, and it cancels out the law of God. And that's what he said. And I think this happens, especially in the Roman Catholic Church, lots of times. The tradition contravenes the teaching of Scripture. I will say this, though.
Partly because they think the Church produced the Bible, so therefore their authority is over the Bible, right?
Well, yes. To qualify, though, the Roman Catholic Church produced the Bible.
That's what,
in one sense, the Church did. If you're thinking of the Church
Universal,
no, I mean
the Roman Catholic Church.
This is a distinction, though. It's a It's an equivocation, though, that is an important point in this discussion. Because in one sense, yes, it was the church that produced the Bible, but it wasn't an ecclesiastical authority like the Roman church that identified which, and in virtue of its authority, invested authority in the writings. It was just the other way around.
It was the authority of the writings that the church recognized.
That's exactly
and made
right.
canon.
That's right. It's the writings that create the church in a certain sense, not the Well, I was going to say not the church that creates writing, but the opposite is true too. But these have to be carefully qualified. I wanted to add one other thing, though, and if I may, and that is that there is a test of Catholicity that's an important factor. If one person comes up with a doctrine that is contrary to what the church has always believed, well, it's not likely that that doctrine is going to be sound. Okay, there's a huge red flag against it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not arguing that tradition isn't important. You're saying tradition alone is not enough to establish something as a good teaching, because a tradition that can be traced back to biblical teaching is important. We recognize the importance of the tradition, the Christian tradition, and their teachings that have been passed down. And like you're saying, novelty in theology is not a good thing.
That's right. That's right. And if the tradition is a sound one, it's because it is grounded in a biblical teaching that we can discover. Okay,
some have said we can check it out in the Bible.
Correct. And some have said, the apostles themselves. I just read this not too long ago in one of the epistles, you know, follow the traditions that we have handed down to you. And then this gives, I think, some Roman Catholics liberty then to authenticate the traditions of their church as the traditions spoken of there. But of course, that doesn't follow. There are traditions that are handed down, but that doesn't mean they're traditions that are other than those things taught in the scriptures. That's a whole different enterprise. If there's a tradition that is not taught, then what is it that gives that tradition some kind of divine authority? And the Roman Church says the magisterium, and I just don't think that's adequate. There's all kinds of mischief that results as when that practice is put into place, and historically that's been the case as well.
Next question comes from Twitter, Perspectives. How should one handle close relatives who have radically different theology and try to undermine the teaching of one's child?
I guess this person means their child's teaching is being undermined by the radically different theology of some other adults in their family community, right?
Right.
Well, I guess it depends on how old the child is. And what is the nature of the disagreement and how aggressive the people are. I think there is a place that one might come to where they say to the other adults and family members involved, you know, you just can't go there with my kid. You know, I am responsible. I am over my child. And so I am going to take responsibility to train up the child in the way I think the child should go. That's not your responsibility, it's mine. And so I think that there's a place for a parent to tell a relative to stand down theologically, okay? Now, on the other hand, I'm thinking of my Annabeth, who you know so well, 11 years old now. I'm not troubled that my daughter would be exposed to alternate views. My role in her life is going to be try to adjudicate those views in private with her and talk her through it. Normally, I think it's really not until you get almost to the rhetoric stage, so early high school, where I think it's going to be most appropriate for there to be a large-scale interaction with ideas. The grammar stage, then the rhetoric stage have to be in place before your kids are going to...
The logic stage.
What did I say?
Rhetoric.
Grammar, then logic. Third. Yeah, so let's grammar school, middle school.
Right.
The contemporary characterizations have to be in place. The tools of those years have to be in place. The particulars and the organizational ability and the ability to think through all of that have to be in place so that when they get to the stage of assessing ideas and governing ideas and interacting and debating ideas and stuff like that, they have the tools to do it. And that's usually the rhetoric stage. So I would allow exposure of my child to these more aggressive attempts to persuade proportionate to the age and development of the child. And at any stage that the child's under my care, I might deem that the circumstances are not appropriate, age appropriate, and I'd say, okay, stand down. I think that's entirely right. Parents are responsible for their kids.
Okay. That's the last question. Time went by fast. I just wanted to mention, won't get into all the specifics, but our speakers, our four speakers, Greg, Brett, Alan, and Tim, all speak around the country, of the United States and Canada, sometimes around the world. And you can find the information on our page. Go to str.org/training/events, and you can see their schedule.
And by the way, around the world, I'll be in Norway in the end of May, and I will be in the UK, London in particular, for sure now.
First weekend of July.
I mean, just to toss it out for those who might be in those areas, they can check our website.
Alan's going to Australia, down with Rodney Lake in May.
That's right. And let's see, any others on the schedule? I guess that's it.
Anyways.
Yeah.
So, go to
New Zealand. That would be New Zealand.
I'm sorry. It's all down under there. So you can find information. Go to str.org/training/events to get information. So that's the show for this week, folks. You can send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STRAsk. That's the name of the podcast. And that's how we find your questions. It's posted every Monday. Available in all the usual places. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.